10. Unhinged. The morning of Monday, July 31st, John Kelly was sworn in as chief of staff in a small private ceremony in the Oval Office. Kelly had just run Homeland Security, a bureaucratic behemoth overseeing a number of competitive agencies, each with its own individual culture. A former combat veteran whose valor on the battlefield had been chronicled in books, Kelly won at first the respect of Trump's staff, including even Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner. "This is the 11th time I've taken this oath to defend the Constitution, and I want everybody here to know I'm here to defend the Constitution and to defend the rule of law," Kelly told the other officials in attendance. When he later addressed the larger staff in the soaring lobby of the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, he pointed out that the oath doesn't say anything in there about being loyal to the president. It doesn't say anything in there about the GOP being more important than your integrity. Kelly's first chore was deciding what to do with communications director Anthony Scaramucci, 53, the flashy Manhattan financier who called himself the Mooch, was friends with the president, and had been recruited as communications director by Ivanka and Kushner, in part to help oust Reince Priebus. Scaramucci unloaded on Priebus and Steve Bannon in an expletive-filled interview with The New Yorker's Ryan Lizza that was conducted on July 26th and published the next day. Minutes before Kelly's July 31st swearing-in ceremony, Scaramucci approached the defense secretary in the West Wing lobby. "Hey, General Mattis," he said. "I know you're close to Kelly. Can you get me a meeting with him? He won't see me." Startled, Mattis replied, "Maybe you ought to talk to his scheduler." "Oh, no," Scaramucci said. "They're blowing me off. General, you don't understand." Mattis tap-danced away from the request. Later that day, Kelly fired Scaramucci. He lasted just 11 days on the job. July 31st also was Ty Cobb's first day in the White House as special counsel for the Russia investigation. Cobb was not personally representing Trump, but was brought in to oversee the White House's involvement in the probe, in part because Don McGahn had recused himself and most of the lawyers in his shop from the investigation because some of them were now witnesses. On his first day, Cobb came to learn that such distinctions were rather blurry in Trump's world. Cobb was filling out administrative paperwork and preparing to move into his new office when two senior officials raised the same request. McGahn and Bannon both asked for Cobb's help removing Kushner and Ivanka from the White House staff. Each of them tried to convince Cobb that this was the most important way to protect the president. McGahn, who was already on bad terms with the president because of his refusal to comply with some of his demands, including to ask Rosenstein about having Robert Mueller removed as special counsel, told Cobb he needed to persuade Trump about the problems his daughter and son-in-law created. Bannon was more forceful, stressing the many obstacles they presented. "You need to shoot them in the fucking head," Bannon jokingly told Cobb. Cobb was wary of making any snap decisions this early, but Cobb's view was also partly shaped by a careful reading of the palace intrigue. Priebus had just been fired, and Bannon might be the next to go, while McGahn had an especially prickly relationship with the president and the kids. Cobb reasoned that he could not get his job done without the support of Kushner and Ivanka, and he came to like and trust them. Cobb had his own instant tensions with McGahn, who had lobbied Trump to appoint other lawyers for Cobb's job. Cobb's first big task was reviewing documents and submitting them to Mueller's team. But he did not initially have a staff, and McGahn initially would not lend him lawyers to help. Cobb learned on his first day that McGahn had been trying to deny Cobb the premium West Wing office Trump had promised him. By September, however, Cobb would have as a deputy Stephen Groves, an able lawyer and skilled strategist who had been U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley's chief of staff at the United Nations. On August 1st, his second day at work, Cobb called James Quarles, Mueller's deputy who was in charge of the special counsel's interactions with the White House, to try to introduce himself. Cobb got a phone call back from Quarles and Michael Dreeben, a soft-spoken and well-known appellate lawyer on the Mueller team. Dreeben explained that Mueller's team was a bit frustrated. They had made a series of requests of the White House and, thus far, had not received a satisfactory reply. In particular, they wanted White House permission to review a key document, one of the draft statements Trump wrote in May in Bedminster as he prepared to fire Comey. Mueller's team felt they were getting stonewalled. They had a general idea about the contents, but had been waiting for the White House to decide if they wanted to hold the document back due to executive privilege concerns. Dreeben laid out for Cobb one way the White House could cooperate. He cited a 2008 opinion under Attorney General Michael Mukasey that found the White House could share sensitive internal documents with another executive branch office, such as the Justice Department, for the purposes of an investigation. As Dreeben explained, the White House wouldn't have to deal with the question of whether these records should be shielded by executive privilege, because under the Mukasey memo, the executive branch would agree not to divulge any of the records without White House permission. Cobb consulted with a career attorney in the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel who confirmed Dreeben's interpretation. The White House would not waive executive privilege or risk anything by sharing internal notes or the recollections of staff with the special counsel. A veteran of previous independent counsel fights, Cobb felt cooperation was the right path for several reasons. Trump had been emphatic with Cobb that he had done nothing wrong and that he wanted to get the investigation over with as quickly as possible. As Cobb saw it, that could be achieved by cooperating fully with the investigators, turning over every document they needed, helping to provide staff witnesses for interviews, and reaching a resolution without subpoenas and court fights. Cobb laid out this cooperative approach to John Dowd and fellow attorney Jay Sekulow, who then explained its virtues to Trump. The Mukasey memo meant no potentially sensitive or embarrassing material would automatically become public without White House agreement, and sharing broadly with Mueller would speed up the investigation. Trump immediately embraced what lawyers on the team dubbed an open kimono strategy. On August 1st, Cobb authorized the Justice Department to give Mueller's team the draft of Trump's letter to fire Comey. Trump lawyers had reviewed four drafts of the termination letter, including the final version that Keith Schiller, the Manila Killer, as one advisor called him, carried in a manila envelope to FBI headquarters. They felt that the letter exonerated Trump of obstructing justice because they believed it showed he was firing Comey for declining to state publicly that the president was not under investigation, not because of corrupt intent to end the Russia probe. Over the next several days, Cobb further consulted the Office of Legal Counsel, reviewed the law, and became even more convinced. He was familiar with a ruling in an independent counsel investigation of Mike Espy, an agriculture secretary under President Clinton, which set a very high bar that investigators had to meet in order to question a president and force his or her testimony. Investigators had to show they couldn't get the information any other way. Under the Espy precedent, the more the White House cooperated by providing detailed records and responsive witnesses, the more difficult it would be for Mueller to subpoena the president himself. You can build a record of cooperation every day that you're cooperating, and every time you're making a production, and every time people are testifying voluntarily. That builds a big mountain, Cobb told Trump and his advisors. Cobb argued that this mountain of cooperation could therefore shield the president from having to answer investigators' questions, which Trump's personal lawyers wanted to avoid, in part out of fear that he might perjure himself, given his tendency to embellish or fabricate. Dowd, who had been meeting with Mueller's team, told Cobb he thought he could see light at the end of the tunnel and a speedy end to the probe, at least as it related to concluding the Trump campaign had engaged in no collusion. Dowd believed that Mueller had assured him he would make a rather quick decision on this and would alert Dowd in the near term. Dowd was cheered by Mueller's insistence that he would move speedily. Cobb liked the sound of that because he felt he could use Mueller's promise of a swift investigation to apply pressure in public by telling reporters that the White House could turn over all its records and witnesses by Thanksgiving or the end of the year. And so the probe could be completed then as well. Dowd shared a rosy outlook with the president. This could be over by the end of January, Dowd told Trump. Cobb, 67, noticed right away that he and Trump had different styles. Cobb liked to think before he spoke, while Trump liked to talk off the cuff, as part of his process of testing ideas and gathering information. Cobb watched Trump throw up in the air theories and proposals to get reactions, but recognized the president as nobody's fool. Cobb was intrigued by Trump's habit of keeping a running score on his senior aide's popularity and performance ratings. Others noticed that the president was obsessed with knocking down as inferior what his predecessors had built. His whole DNA is, whatever anybody else has done is stupid. I'm smarter, and therefore that's why he goes around breaking glass all the time, one senior Republican senator recalled. He's torn a lot of things up. He likes to break things. But what has he put together yet? In August, the West Wing underwent a renovation for 2 weeks, so Trump had a change of scenery. The staff was displaced just as Kelly was settling into his new post, and Trump decamped to his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey. Trump was hypersensitive to any suggestion that he was on vacation, even though he effectively was, and he ordered aides to plan public events each day, a briefing on health care, or a roundtable session on opioids, for instance. But they occupied only an hour or so of his time, and he spent the rest of each day playing a round of golf, chatting with friends in the clubhouse, and hanging out in his private cottage. Trump was accompanied by a small coterie of aides, including Kelly, Communications Director Hope Hicks, and Staff Secretary Rob Porter. But he spent hours each day alone in the cottage, watching cable news and reading newspapers. Aides carted up from Washington boxes that contained back issues of the New York Times and the Washington Post that the president had not had a chance to fully peruse in the White House. The extensive news coverage about Mueller's investigation, pure hate, as Bannon would refer to it, put Trump in a foul mood. Can you believe how obsessed they are with this? Trump fumed to aides. It's so overblown. That's all they want to talk about. This is so ridiculous. We didn't do anything. Trump was not only bothered by the Russia investigation, he was confounded over what to do about North Korea. Ever since Obama had told him, back in November 2016, that North Korea would be the greatest challenge he would confront as president, Trump had been vexed by the security threat posed by Kim Jong-un. A series of missile tests in the spring and summer of 2017 rattled him, and as he vacationed at Bedminster, He was getting regular updates from National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster and other officials about the rogue regime. On August 8th, Trump issued a fresh warning to Kim after North Korea vowed to develop a nuclear arsenal capable of reaching the U.S. mainland. "They will be met with fire and fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before," Trump said, folding his arms and staring straight into the cameras. The bellicose threat was interpreted as yet another unscripted presidential eruption, but one with the consequence of escalating the war of words between the two countries and their unpredictable leaders. Trump's advisors rushed to reassure suddenly jittery world leaders that Trump's statement was part of an agreed policy of pressure on Pyongyang. But Trump's intimates recognized that there was no grand strategy at play and that the president was unsettled. During his stay in Bedminster, Trump invited Chris Christie and his wife, Mary Pat, over for dinner one night. The three of them ate in private on the patio. Melania was away, and in fact had visited the White House only occasionally in the winter and spring, living instead in New York so that their son, Barron, could finish the school year there. Trump was usually punctual to dinner, but he got to the table about 15 minutes late and seemed preoccupied, even rattled. Trump had known the Christies for nearly two decades, and he and Mary Pat always hugged and kissed when they saw each other. But this time, the president extended his hand for a more formal shake. Once Trump sat down, he didn't say much. The Christies were used to dinners in which they listened to Trump gab for 2 hours straight. But this time, the president was mostly silent. Trump eventually explained the reason for his delay. He had just been on calls with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and South Korean President Moon Jae-in, discussing the nuclear brinkmanship with North Korea. "It's really complicated," Trump told the Christies, adding that he needed the New Jersey governor to give him regular advice on what to do. It was immediately clear to his guests that the North Korea quandary simply overwhelmed Trump. The Mueller investigation kept needling Trump at every turn. On August 9th, while he was still in Bedminster, the president watched the jarring news reports that FBI agents had raided the home of Paul Manafort, his former campaign chairman. Using a search warrant, agents had entered Manafort's Alexandria, Virginia home in the early morning hours of July 26th. And seized a trove of documents and other materials related to the Russia probe. This was Mueller's first shock and awe move, and it signaled a newly aggressive phase of the investigation. Trump was unnerved. "Pretty tough stuff," he told reporters of the FBI's tactics. Privately, Trump told his advisors he was at once worried about Manafort's well-being and upset that the media portrayed them as close. "The press is acting like we're best friends," Trump lamented to Kelly, Porter, and Hicks. That weekend, a group of white supremacists and neo-Nazis held a Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. People marched in a nighttime parade on August 11th, holding tiki torches and chanting, "Jews will not replace us." And on August 12th, their daytime celebration of white nationalism turned deadly when one of the white supremacists deliberately drove his car into a crowd of peaceful counter-protesters, killing one woman and injuring 28 others. Trump said there were very fine people on both sides, and initially refused to condemn white supremacy, a stunning ambiguity that drew bipartisan opprobrium. This abdication of moral leadership was one of the lowest points of his presidency and inspired one of his top advisors, National Economic Council Director Gary Cohn, to do an on-the-record interview with the Financial Times condemning his handling of Charlottesville. The white supremacist rally occurred during the time that cities around the country, from Annapolis to New Orleans to Louisville, were removing monuments to the Confederacy. Trump opposed what was happening. "Sad to see the history and culture of our great country being ripped apart with the removal of our beautiful statues and monuments," he tweeted on August 17th. Trump had told his aides many times that summer, "This is a shame. They're destroying our heritage. This is ridiculous." On August 18th, after almost a week of racial unrest over Trump's handling of Charlottesville, and with Kelly trying to break up the West Wing's warring factions, Trump dismissed Bannon, putting out to pasture the advisor who had most zealously channeled his pugilistic and nationalist impulses. Locked in a tortuous ideological and personal feud with Kushner, McMaster, and other senior aides he derided as globalists, Bannon came to embody the White House's dysfunction and self-destructive tendencies. Bannon considered himself a historical figure, likening his work for Trump to leading a revolution, and he cast his departure as the end of an era. "The Trump presidency that we fought for and won is over," he said in an exit interview with the Weekly Standard, adding that he felt liberated and vowing to achieve even greater influence from outside the government. "I feel jacked up. Now I'm free. I've got my hands back on my weapons. Someone said, it's Bannon the Barbarian." The discarding of Bannon underscored the fact that the president wanted all the glory for himself. He had deeply resented the Saturday Night Live portrayal of Bannon as the Grim Reaper, making presidential decisions behind the resolute desk, while Trump played with an expandable toy from behind a kiddie desk. With Bannon out, Kelly centralized power inside the White House and inspired new confidence that he could get the president to act more like a president. On August 23rd, Trump flew to Phoenix for a rally, his first since Charlottesville. His supporters had waited for hours in 107-degree heat to get through security, and a quartet of introductory speakers, including Alveda King, a niece of Martin Luther King Jr., and the evangelist Franklin Graham, delivered carefully scripted speeches denouncing racism and praising Trump as a unifier. Then the president took the stage and ranted and rambled for 75 minutes, 16 of which he spent attacking the damned dishonest media for their coverage of his Charlottesville equivocations. At one point, Trump called Kelly onto the stage. "Where's John?" the president asked. "Where is he? Where's General Kelly? Get him out here. He's great. He's doing a great job." Kelly did not go on stage, which irritated Trump, who later vented to other aides that his chief of staff did not follow his command. Trump had begun chafing against Kelly's restrictions, which his deputy, Kirstjen Nielsen, brusquely enforced. She ordered shut the doors of the Oval Office to block staffers from wandering in without appointments, screened the president's phone calls, making it harder for outside friends to get patched in, and mandated pre-screening any papers, including the printouts of news stories about himself that Trump liked to read, before they reached the president's desk. Just about everything Kelly did ran counter to Trump's spontaneity, setting the two men on a collision course. Trump was embarrassed by the media narrative that Kelly was managing the president with his rigid structures. Kelly instructed White House operators to patch him into many of Trump's calls so that he could hear what people told the president and vice versa. And Kelly tried to restrict who had direct access. When some of his friends complained that their calls were not connected, Trump sometimes yelled at his personal assistant, Madeline Westerhout, "People say they've not been able to reach me for 2 weeks. the president fumed. Westerhout blocked the calls under Kelly's orders. Worse, though, Trump thought Kelly was acting morally superior. Trump started derisively dubbing him the church lady behind his back. The danger for Kelly was that insiders, too, were starting to turn against him over his strict new procedures. It was Trump, of course, who birthed this nest of vipers, allowing his staff to snipe at foes and sometimes rewarding them for it. Some Trump loyalists had come to consider the West Wing's chaos a ladder for personal ambition, back-channeling to the president and influencing the government in ways beyond the scope of their positions. But once their wings were clipped, they sought to undermine Kelly in ways the new chief of staff did not necessarily see. When you take Fallujah, you know the incoming is coming directly in front of you because you can see it, one Trump advisor explained. When you're in Washington, it's coming from everywhere. You don't know if I'm killing you from inside the tent or outside the tent. At the outset, Kelly decided not to give Ivanka and Kushner special treatment, a move that would later lead the kids to conspire against him and imperil his ability to manage effectively. Corey Lewandowski, Trump's former campaign manager, who remained close to the president and was among those outsiders Kelly tried to isolate, sought to warn the new chief of staff. Early in Kelly's tenure, Lewandowski explained what he saw as a survival mechanism in Trump world. Embrace the family, because when you're home having Thanksgiving dinner with your family, they're with the president, and if you don't embrace them, you're going to lose. But Kelly did not embrace the family. He made clear he expected Ivanka and Kushner to act as regular staffers and abide by his rules, including that they first seek his approval before discussing any policy or political matters with the president. Privately, Kelly told Mattis and other administration officials that he thought Ivanka and Kushner were idiots and needed to leave the White House because we've just got to run this country. Naturally, the kids came to resent Kelly, believing he and his enforcers, chief among them Nielsen, were trying to erode their influence and access, which in the Priebus era had largely been unfettered. They're trying to fuck me, Kushner told confidants. Kelly was nearly killing himself in the job. He woke up most mornings at 4, and his Secret Service detail waited outside his home in Manassas, Virginia, to drive him to work. On the roughly 45-minute drive, there was no traffic at that pre-dawn hour, Kelly read The Washington Post, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, Politico, the Fox News and Breitbart websites, and Axios. He learned early in the job that the president's addiction to press accounts of himself was so strong that Kelly's daily tasks and discussions inevitably would be determined by the news cycle. Once he got to the White House, CIA officials went over the latest intelligence with him for the president's daily brief. Until Trump came down from the residence, usually between 11 a.m. and noon, a remarkably late start time for a commander-in-chief, Kelly did normal staff work. But the moment the president arrived in the Oval Office, all normalcy flew out the window, and Kelly stayed glued to his side. Once Trump went back to the residence, around 5 or 6 in the evening, Kelly snuck in a couple more hours of work. On many days, he slept only 4 or 5 hours. Famously blunt, Kelly routinely commiserated with other staffers about the difficulties of working for Trump. He can't make up his mind, the chief of staff once told aides. He says one thing and does another thing. Look what I have to deal with. Still, Kelly was considered a stabilizing force on Capitol Hill, where veteran lawmakers had been watching Trump's presidency aghast. They saw Kelly, Mattis, and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson as essential guardrails for an erratic president. Bob Corker, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee chairman, gave voice to this sentiment on October 4th when he told reporters, "I think Secretary Tillerson, Secretary Mattis, and Chief of Staff Kelly are those people that help separate our country from chaos, and I support them very much." Corker's willingness to say what he believed about Trump made him a rare breed among Republican lawmakers, and his "separate our country from chaos" quote immediately made the rounds on cable television, drawing notice from the nation's viewer-in-chief. Concerned about the president's agitation, Kelly called Corker that afternoon. "Bob, what in the hell happened today?" he asked. Corker explained that he simply responded truthfully to a question he was asked by a reporter. "If you want me to quit complimenting you, I will," Corker said. Kelly laughed. Trump got more spun up the more the Corker quote was replayed on television, and on October 8th, the president attacked Corker on Twitter. Trump stated falsely that Corker had begged him for his endorsement, and that after the president said no, the senator decided not to run for re-election. In fact, Trump had told Corker several times he would endorse him, and earlier that week had called, asking the senator to reconsider his decision and seek another term. Corker responded about an hour later with a tweet of his own. "It's a shame the White House has become an adult daycare center. Someone obviously missed their shift this morning." As Kelly and others were trying to help steer Trump away from dangerous impulses, Mueller and his team were trying to excavate every detail of the Russian cyber attack on the 2016 election. These investigators were combing through tens of thousands of Democratic emails the Russian government had stolen, on orders from Vladimir Putin to damage Hillary Clinton's bid for the White House. This required old-fashioned detective work, like tracing the footprints of a burglar, but through the dark digital trails traveled by shadowy spies and hackers. The team compared which of the Democratic National Committee emails were held, in identical form, in the computer troves of WikiLeaks. The team, led by the former federal prosecutor Jeannie Rhee and her tireless partner Rush Atkinson, informally called the search Hack and Dump, though they would later settle on the catchier name Matchy Matchy. This was serious work, however. They charted the hack to establish the computer theft, pulled off by the GRU's Secret Political Dirty Tricks Division, Unit 26165. The elite team of computer scientists, based in offices in central Moscow, was formed in the Cold War as a critical signals decrypting office for the Soviet military, and had recently been described on a Russian website as able to decipher any code within 3 minutes and re-encrypt it without breaking away from writing a doctoral dissertation on quantum physics. The unit's officers had created buffer servers between their own operation and the Democratic servers to store what they stole and based them in Arizona, an apparent effort to throw people off their trail. Tracking the dump was in some ways far more important to establishing proof of criminal interference in the election. Another GRU division, Unit 74455, pushed out the material after creating two phony personas. The website DC Leaks, which hosted the hacked goodies, and the social media figure Guccifer 2.0. who pretended to be an individual hacker and tried to communicate with journalists and other key influencers. Tracing the hacker's theft was like chasing a house burglar. "It's like the house was robbed, some jewelry was taken," said one person familiar with the work. The bracelet that was taken is now in this pawn shop on the corner. We found the same bracelet. We've got a match. On October 30th, Trump woke before dawn, clicked on the television, and burrowed in to await the bombshell he expected that morning. It was a Monday, the day before Halloween, and all weekend there was rampant media speculation that Mueller was preparing his first indictments. After being given a heads up from the Justice Department about the imminent indictments from Mueller, Trump watched live footage of Manafort and his deputy, Rick Gates, both one-time confidants of the president, turning themselves in to the FBI. They were being charged with tax fraud, hiding millions of dollars in income, and deceiving the federal government about their secret lobbying work for pro-Russian leaders in Ukraine. Trump was pleased and relieved that the charges against Manafort and Gates were focused primarily on activities that began before his campaign. At 10:28 a.m., he tweeted, "There is no collusion." Within minutes, the media discovered a link between the Trump campaign and Russia. Prosecutors unsealed court documents showing that 3 weeks earlier, Trump's campaign advisor, George Papadopoulos, pleaded guilty to making false statements to the FBI about having received advance warning from a Russian intelligence operative that Russia had obtained damaging information about Hillary Clinton. Trump grew angry, and in the corridors of the White House that day, the mood was one of weariness and fear of the unknown. Staffers were in freak-out mode. The president had detested Gates, but genuinely felt bad for Manafort, believing prosecutors were charging him with long-ago crimes as a means of ensnaring Trump. "It's a shame," Trump told McGahn not long after the charges were brought. "It had nothing to do with the campaign. It was all this stuff before he met me." Most of all, Trump was furious that the charges created so much bad publicity for himself, a sort of guilt by association. The president urged his lawyers to point out publicly that the charges had no connection to him or his campaign. "Why don't the papers report that?" Trump groused. "This was when he worked for President Reagan." He added, "I barely knew him. I need you to tell the press that." Trump's advisors had seen him fall into this pit before. He couldn't sit still and ride out the storm. He always wanted to be on offense. Cobb had to explain to him that the White House should never say anything about Manafort. "Nothing Manafort's charged with involves the White House, and it's very defensive," Cobb said. "It suggests some anxiety about Manafort." Trump often raised his voice at other aides, but not to Cobb. He seemed to respect Cobb's calm, matter-of-fact tone. He slumped in his chair and complied with his lawyer's advice. Cobb reminded Trump and his political advisors that Manafort's lawyers had already addressed the media from the federal courthouse steps and made clear Manafort had no unflattering information about Trump to share with prosecutors. "You should just let that be the record rather than muddying the record," Cobb told him. That was welcome news to Trump, but unbeknownst to the president, Mueller was working to secure another cooperating witness. The special counsel's team would next move in to talk to Trump's former national security advisor.